Welcome everyone to the Damage Report on a fantastic first day. I am here, very excited. This is my final day guest hosting because that is right, the dragon daddy who finally became a daddy. So there's no longer a Z in front of that addy. He's coming back, guys, on Monday. So I'll be there back on Monday, but I'm very excited to do this final news roundup with none other than Rayvanna herself. Rayvanna, how are you?
I'm good. I'm feeling good because this morning, in a completely surprise move to me, my senator, Dick Durbin, was the first senator to call for a ceasefire. And seeing somebody in such a high position of authority within the Democratic leadership in the Senate do that, it has made my morning very good.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not doing that story, but it is important to note it was an interview. And it's like, do you think we need a ceasefire? And he's like, yeah, it's time, which, you know, he could have said humanitarian pause, which is, I guess, what we're going with here. And we'll get into a lot of the backlash that Biden and Democrats are facing around the world, actually. But that is heartening news. Look, I think we got to call in people. We got to say, look, Dick Durbin, you a corporatist, and we've all seen this in a lot of ways, but you're doing the right thing here. And let's stop the bloodshed. But we have a little bit of those updates. We're going to get into some Trump legal updates. We're going to get into Ohio trying to defend the right to an abortion in their constitution. This is huge. A little bit of Roe Khanna v. Vivek Ramaswamy. How did that go down? Why did it go down? I don't know. Branding. We'll get into that. And then interestingly, the GOP saves Rashida Tlaib. That's right. What happened? Why? And also George Santos. So less exciting. But what happened on the floor of Congress? We'll look into that. But for now, you guys know what to do. Don't act brand new. Or if you are brand new, welcome. Please like the stream. Please share it. Become a member if you want access to a bunch of more content. John and I will be back on Monday doing our top 10 list. So super excited for that. That is for tier 2 and tier 3 members. And thank you as always for your support, your super chats, your comments, the doc that I haven't opened that I should open so I can read your super chats and comments. We'll be reading those throughout our social break. But with that, why don't we just open with this recognition and a rest in peace for Adi Barkin, who was a well-known activist who campaigned for Medicare for All, despite suffering and because of suffering with ALS, which is a terminal neurodegenerative disease. He died. He was 39 years old. This was from his wife, who posted on his Instagram page saying, his Twitter saying, "Hi, this is Adi's wife, Rachel. I'm devastated to share the news that Adi has died from complications of ALS. You probably knew Adi as a healthcare activist, but more importantly, he was a wonderful dad and my life partner for 18 years. Now, I think it's just really important to stop down and remember that this is someone who has been arrested multiple times in the halls of Congress, standing with other disability rights folks who are standing for not just protecting Medicare, but expanding it to all people. And he and others who have terminal illness, who need long-term care, know that it is literally impossible to survive or live a quality life, to be able to have 18 years with your partner and have two children. If you need constant round the clock care, you have to be rich. You have to be wealthy to do that. He was not, his family was not. They are raising funds now to help with in memory of Adi Barkin. So there is a GoFundMe. I'll just throw that up here, and it's remembering dash 80. So, Ray, just any thoughts on this? I mean, of all the people you would imagine fighting for Medicare for All, like someone who has lost all use of their limbs, their voice, you know, someone who's suffering, like this is true. He was truly a hero.
Absolutely. And I think that a lot of people, when they think of the disabled community, they sort of paint a picture, people who are not involved with disability rights, organizing, people who, you know, maybe don't have anyone in their family that, you know, is involved in the disability rights movement. They think of a tacit group of people who are suffering. But, you know, in my experience as a disabled person protesting for disability rights, working in disability rights advocacy, they're some of the people who are most willing to do civil disobedience. They're the people who are most willing to hit the streets because they have to become out out of necessity advocates for themselves. We have to become our own best advocates because oftentimes no one else is going to do it for us. AD was a giant in the community, and this is a devastating loss. So I just, you know, I implore anybody who has the means, who's able to contribute to the GoFundMe, please do. If you don't, totally understandable. Please share the link because, you know, some people in your network might be able to contribute. So, you know, in any way that you can give back, please do. And, you know, remember that the disability community is on the front lines of the fight for Medicare for all, not just tacit supporters of it, but, you know, leaders in this movement. And AD will be missed, definitely.
Yeah. And everyone should go back and watch some of his interviews. He is incredibly, he's just an incredible thinker on all this. And again, he's fighting for not just himself and others in the disabled community, but all of us. And let's take up this mantle, right? Anyway, thank you so much, AD, for all of your work. Rest in power. And let's jump into someone a lot less heroic, beginning with this.
I should have worn makeup.
I mean, you should probably use like a Crest white strip. Like, I don't know about makeup, but yeah, like he's looking a little yellow there, Don Jr. That was Don Jr. in his day to testify in the New York civil trial against the Trump Organization. Again, this is about overinflation of assets and committing fraud. And so going over the highlights of this first day with the first of three of Trump's children who are going to be testifying, Barron and Tiff narrowly escaped. Don Trump Jr. struggled. He struggled specifically to answer why the former CFO of the Trump Organization, Alan Weisselberg, resigned the way he did. He said because of some legal issues he got himself into. Yeah, sure. Associated with whom? Trump Jr. said declining to offer specifics about Weisselberg's guilty plea on tax evasion charges last year, previously giving lengthy answers to questions about his background and even smiling with the judge. Trump Jr. appeared tense on the witness stand as he answered questions about Weisselberg. The specific event he was indicted. Cool, we knew that. He was also indicted because of all of the gifts that he received from the Trump family. The penthouses, the college tuitions being paid for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. He, however, Trump Jr. distanced himself from the main question, which is what was your role in overinflating your family's assets? Specifically, between 2016 and 2021, he signed a bunch of financial statements that was like, yep, this is accurate. But he said, I might have signed it, but like, I just kind of skimmed it. He said, quote, I was not involved in the compilation of the statement of financial condition, placing responsibility on his accountants. Did you work on the statement of financial condition for June 30th, 2017? State Attorney Colleen Faherty asked. I did not. The accountants worked on it. That's what we paid them to do, Trump Jr. said. Assistant Attorney General, that's Colleen Faherty, narrowed in, however, on these licensing development deals on financial statements, specifically a $246 million valuation attached to those licensing deals. Trump Jr. said he might have talked about the deals, but he did not add that evaluation to it. He said, quote, I didn't give them a value of $246 million. I could have sat there and gone through each one of the deals individually with Alan Weisselberg, Jeff McConney, Donald Bender. Lovely name, and given them an idea of what I believe cash flow coming from those deals would have been worth, not even knowing it was for the purposes of this, I could have very well been involved in inferring that number, but not knowing it was for that purpose. What? I like might have been involved. They could have been involved unbeknownst to me. I know numbers 2, 4, and 6. I didn't put them together. I didn't add million after them. So this is sort of a denial, but like, kind of a walk back. He's covering his entire ass in this. But obviously, Eric Trump Jr. Or Eric Trump, there's no senior that we know of. And Ivanka will be testifying next. But Ray, what do you make of this? I mean, they're finally, you know, the idea of like a branch off franchise that these kids really are like tacking, like that's what they need. That's what they need. If Trump doesn't get reelected, they need to be able to have business deals, perhaps in New York, so they can keep making money and cheating people out of their money.
I really enjoyed this because, you know, the first thing I learned in law school is ignorance of the law is a defense. It's the best defense, in fact. And that's what Donald Trump Jr. is raising at this trial. I mean, at the end of the day, he had to sign off on these financial documents, right? He had to sign off on the accuracy of these financial statements. So trying to write off responsibility onto the accountants is total and utter BS. You can't do that. You, at the end of the day, were supposed to inspect the documents, ensure their accuracy, and you signed your name on the bottom of the sheet. You can't now just say, well, I didn't read them, Your Honor. I didn't actually see what was written in the financial statements. I just put my name on the line where they told me to. And, you know, however much cocaine contributed to his not caring enough to go over the documents, you know, I can't be certain. I'm sure that it was not no cocaine.
I mean, we can be sure.
Right. It's completely silly. It's a non-argument. And he's obviously scared. He's very scared, and his demeanor between shifting between when he was deposed to now being on the stand is evidence of that.
Yeah. Should I have worn makeup? Yeah, he's super scared. This has been televised. And yeah, I think the other big scary thing is your dad gonna flip on you? Because if you're the one signing this document, the buck does stop with you. Like, you can blame accountants, but at the end of the day, you just admitted you hired those accountants. Like, I don't know, Ray, doesn't it seem like that your legal responsibility is the person who signed their name on these overvaluations?
Oh, absolutely. That is literally, you know, he holds legal responsibility. He could, in effect, sue the accountants,
sure,
or try to show that the accountants were grossly negligent in compiling the documents, but it's only going to reflect back on him because he was involved in the valuation of the assets. He was directly involved, so he's not going to do that. He doesn't want them to look further right into that because it's only going to further implicate him. But at the end of the day, yeah, you're exactly right. He signed off on them. You know, the responsibility does rest with him.
And it's interesting because we know that from Michael Cohen's testimony in this case, that Trump would come in, Trump Senior would come in with a number, and that accountants and everyone else, project managers, would just have to reach that number in the paperwork. Okay, we're just going to 300 million. Great. Let's somehow fudge the numbers to get you your 300 million or whatever X amount you're worth so that you finally will be back on the Forbes list, which is all you care about. Judge Eileen Cannon indicated on Wednesday that she is perhaps going to delay the start of that documents trial, pointing to the fact that he's got so many other criminal cases coming at him. How could he have time to do this one? We all know that Eileen Cannon is a Trump appointed judge, is a judge favorable to the former president. U.S. District Judge Eileen Cannon appeared ready to side with Trump's attorneys in their request to postpone the trial, saying she, quote, has a hard time seeing how realistically this current schedule would work, even as prosecutors pushed her to keep the schedule start date. She also pointed to the 1.3 million pages of evidence that prosecutors in the Mar-a-Lago case have provided to the defense, along with thousands of hours of security video shot at Trump's resort. She questioned whether Trump's lawyers would have adequate time to review the evidence in the next 6 months. I'm not quite seeing a level of understanding on your part to these realities, Cannon told prosecutor Jay Bratt, a member of Jack Smith's team, which is, I don't know, sounds incredibly biased to me. It doesn't sound like she's being a very honest arbiter of the law, but hey, what do I know? The prosecutor told Cannon that Trump's attorneys from the beginning have pushed to delay the trial until after November 2024 and the election, when he hopes to win back the White House from President Joe Biden. And I'm sure there'll still be an ongoing trial after that. He says that because of the defense motions to delay the Washington trial and dismiss those charges, there's a chance that trial will be postponed. He told Cannon that she, quote, should not let the DC trial drive the schedule here. Brad also outlined how his team is helping the defense. Like, hey, let me just, y'all remember, I mean, not to be super Giuliani about it, but you know, like the scene in My Cousin Vinny where like the prosecution helps the defense a little bit. It's like, oh yeah, you can have access to all the evidence and information that I have. What is it called? Exposure, exposition?
Discovery.
Discovery. God damn it, I was so close. He said his team has provided Trump's lawyers with a directory to the Mar-a-Lago documents to assist their preparation and advise them on the portions of the security video they plan to play at the trial. Footage that prosecutors have said shows boxes being moved in and out of the storage room at the property in an effort to conceal them from investigators. In other words, just direct you to the relevant stuff. You don't have to watch thousands of hours of Mar-a-Lago footage, although someone should, and I really want like the sizzle of those hours. But Ray, what do you make of this? I mean, this is arguably the most one of the most egregious cases, just because it was such a dumb move. But yeah, I'm not sure it's the one anyone cares the most about.
Which is interesting, because I think it's the one that will be the most cut and dry guilty verdict. I mean, the evidence is clear. There's no argument to make opposing the charges.
Right.
The arguments that they have sort of tried to play out so far in the media have been completely bogus. And so I can see why a Trump-appointed judge would want to delay this till after the election, once Trump can just pardon himself. And I'll say, I saw a lot of people in the chat saying the judge needs to recuse herself, to which I just say, ha. That's never going to happen. Not in a million years. We have judges not recusing themselves when they have financial ties to defendants. All across this country, that happens.
They're sitting on the Supreme Court.
Exactly, exactly. The highest court in the land. It doesn't matter there. And they don't have, right, the same, they don't have any ethics rules as opposed to lower courts. Lower courts that do have ethics rules imposed violate them flagrantly, and there is no accountability for that. And it happens every day in this country. It's despicable. It's despicable. I mean, we've had a private prosecutions that included jail time funded by Chevron. I mean, this is the legal system in this country is despicable. Just as because I mentioned that, I'll say I've been getting a lot of Twitter ads from Chevron, funded Chevron ads, casting Donziger?
What is Donziger?
Yeah, as a criminal. So just the state of what's allowed in this country. But yeah, this judge is not going to recuse herself. I think at the end of the day, this trial should not be postponed until after the election, because then Trump's again just going to be in a position, if he wins, to pardon himself. So, and yeah. I think that's what she's hoping for.
I mean, what's interesting about this, I wish we had more access to the information. The reason I think it is so important is not that he kept the documents, right? It's what he did with them. It's what kinds of documents he kept. You know, I think this is, everyone is, including MAGA, I think they know it was wrong. Republicans, I think, know it was stupid, but they're like, whatever. He wanted to keep them. He's the president. That's fine. Everybody keeps stuff, even though they don't. And specifically what he took, you know, the kinds of information around the Department of Defense, the kinds of information about which countries around the world have nuclear weapons, the kinds of information that he's been peddling around Mar-a-Lago perpetually, right? Leading to like the purchase of submarines from the Australian government, right? Like, this is not without impact. And so for sure, like, everything else is all these other trials are like the financial crimes, the, you know, January 6th insurrection, the election, attempt to overturn the election in Georgia. This is all things that happened in the past. The document scandal are arguably things that, you know, sort of are foreshadowing more of what this person could do if he were still in power, or if he weren't in some way restricted from sharing the kinds of information that he has, right? Or I don't know what kind of photos, like this is kind of an ongoing crime, if you will. So arguably the most important, even though it seems like everyone's like, nah, whatever, who wouldn't want to keep a keepsake?
Tactical invasion plans of Iran, a little memento from my time
exactly.
in White House.
Exactly, right. Oh my God, which he's just peddling.
Showing to everybody, anybody who will look.
I'm not going to say which country. It starts with I. And it ends with not walk, but ran. Okay, let's take our first break. We'll be right back after this. All right, well, let's dig into this. The debate that nobody asked for. Let's go.
Republican views on climate are shifting, and now one out of three Republicans think that climate change should be declared a national emergency. Are they right or wrong?
I'm not one of those three Republicans.
Yeah.
I disagree.
One out of three, but yeah.
So I believe facts matter here.
But you couldn't even get the one out of three. You couldn't even understand his question right. But so that is Vivek Ramaswamy in part of a debate with Representative Ro Khanna, which focused on climate change, the economy, and foreign affairs. And so he believes facts matters. Let's hear Vivek out. What kinds of facts is he spewing at this debate? Take a listen.
Are global surface temperatures going up? Yes, they are. Is that likely owed to some man-made causes? Likely. However, this is not an existential risk for humanity. And to the contrary, 8 times as many people are going to die this year of cold temperatures rather than warm ones. In the 1970s, the warning of climate change was an ice age. Look at the cover of Newsweek. Today, they warned the other direction. You want to think about the climate disaster related death rate, the number of people who dies from tornadoes, heat waves, and so on, down by 98% over the last century. Why? Owing to fossil fuels. The Earth is more covered by green surface area coverage today than it was a half century or a century ago. Why? Because carbon dioxide is plant food.
What? Carbon dioxide is plant food? Come on now, bro. So there he was. And sadly, Ro Khanna didn't have a strong retort, because I think Vivek participates in that debate strategy where you just tell so many lies and you just keep on going. It's difficult to sort of like catch each one of them. We attempted to, at least thanks to Mike here at the Damage Report, specifically. And this is our favorite. I mean, my favorite when it comes to climate denialism. They're like, yeah, it happens. Yeah, it's man-made, but more people die of cold. You don't understand how climate change works if you're still spouting that lie, because we're talking about extreme temperatures. These could be cold or hot. Global warming contributes to those kinds of extremes. So it doesn't matter, obviously, whether it's too hot or too cold, but also more than 8 million people worldwide die each year from breathing, polluted air that contains particles from fossil fuel emissions, things that he considers, you know, saviors. The staggering number accounts for nearly 1 in 5 of all deaths in 2018, which is wild, wild. The ice age versus global warming. Again, this is the idea that he was talking about, like, oh no, people are dying of cold. Yeah, the supposed global cooling consensus among climate scientists in 1970s, frequently offered by global warming skeptics as proof that climatologists can't make up their minds, is a myth. According to a survey of the scientific literature of the era, Thomas Peterson of the National Climate Data Center surveyed dozens of peer-reviewed scientific articles from the 1965 and 1979, found that only 7 supported global cooling, while 44 predicted warming. But that's not even what I think Vivek is doing. He's just saying it's actually also getting colder, which again fits perfectly with climate chaos. And then finally, the idea that, there's 2 more things, but the idea that fossil fuels is helping, is preventing natural disaster deaths. I mean, Ray, do you want to take this? I could quote stats, but
Yeah, it was just absurd. But I'll say right before that, he said that there are less people dying of climate events like hurricanes, tornadoes over the last 100 years, which is maybe one of the they're all horrendously stupid arguments that he made. But the reason for that is not that there has been less tornadoes, less hurricanes. In fact, if you look, the numbers going in the opposite direction in that case, it's because we have better detection systems than we did 100 years ago, better warning systems, easier ways to communicate to the people of the communities that are going to be affected by these weather events, that they need to leave. We have better infrastructure so that they can leave. We have better regulations over how housing is constructed so that they're more resilient to these types of weather events, which is not a permanent solution. I want to be clear. That's not in any way, shape, or form a permanent solution. Obviously, it doesn't actually offset climate change. It just makes it slightly more bearable to live in the places that are being primarily impacted by it for the time being. But like to say that we have less deaths because of these than 100 years ago. Yeah, I would hope so.
And it's also in relation, like, it's the same thing with the, like, oh, this is the hottest summer, this is the hottest October, since we've been clocking how hot summers and like months are. And they're like, yeah, but before 150 years ago, it was actually really cool. And you're like, what are you talking about, dude? But yeah, in terms of the disaster-related deaths, the World Meteorological Organization says a disaster related to weather, climate, or water hazard occurred every day on average over the past 50 years, killing 115 people and causing $202 million in losses daily. The number of disasters has increased by a factor of 5 over the past 50 years, driven by climate change, more extreme weather, and improved reporting, as you just mentioned, Ray. But thanks to improved early warnings and disaster management, the number of deaths decreased threefold. Again, people are being, they can leave, they might not be able to come back to their homes.
Here's what's wrong with the economy. You get a lot of statistics from the White House that would teach you that, or try to teach you, that, oh, we're doing great in terms of the economy and Bidenomics has been a success. Here's why people don't actually experience that in their life. Prices are going up. Interest rates, that includes mortgage rates to buy a new home or otherwise, mortgage rates are going up. And wages have remained flat. So that's where the struggle actually comes from. What do you do to address it? I think it's not that complicated. Increase the supply of everything that's worth producing in the United States. Increase the supply of energy. Drill, frack, burn coal, embrace nuclear energy. That brings energy costs down, it drives economic growth. Bring housing costs down by increasing the supply of housing. Land use regulations that we need to get rid of so people can build more new homes. Grows the economy, brings the price of housing down. Same thing with respect to food. Go down that list. And the net result is going to be economic growth, but the basic obstacle is the administrative state.
Oh, there's so much wrong in this, and I will play Ro Khanna's, but it's just amazing to me that he names the problem, Ray. He's like, you know, and wages have remained flat. So what we need to do is, and you're like, raise the minimum wage, raise the minimum wage, raise wages, pay people more. We need to increase supply, right? And he starts off with fossil fuels as if we don't already know that fossil fuel companies are sitting on so many untapped wells. They're sitting on an excess of fossil fuels. And yet they're like, no, we're not going to lower the price, actually, because it's not good for them to do that. They don't want to lower the price. They want to keep the profits that are being made, and they want to force Biden to go beg the, you know, crown prince of Saudi Arabia to lower the prices for them. So it's just like, you don't know anything about the economy if you take out who actually is the arbitrator of the profits that are being made. Are these companies publicly owned? If they were, I might have a different answer. But the fact is, the more supply you have, the more greedy rich people, unless the administrative state actually taxes them fairly or requires them to not sort of become massive monopolies and conglomerates, they'll just keep on keeping the money for themselves. Mm-hmm. Increase the supply of housing. You're such an idiot.
It's so ridiculous too, because like, yeah, you're right. He identified the problem, like wages are stagnant, but his solution was not increase wages. It was just, you know, massive handouts to capitalists. And I'm someone who does believe that we need to increase the availability of housing for people, but that doesn't mean just allowing, real estate developers to create buildings on, you know, valuable land and then hold those until housing prices skyrocket and then fill those units, right?
Or
never fill those units, because sometimes it's more lucrative for them to never fill those units. It's changing the way that we regulate land development, we regulate housing in this country. And I mean, we just saw a landmark ruling against the Association of Realtors, over $1 billion that they owe in damages for price fixing for housing. Mm. I mean, we can't just allow these organizations to run rampant with no regulations. That absolutely does not help the cost of housing. It doesn't help drive wages up. What we're seeing in unionization efforts helps drive wages up. It helps protect jobs. I mean,
yes.
5,000 jobs just restored in the Belvedere plant because of this UAW strike. a plant that was shut down months ago and now is going to be not just opening back up, but we're going to see another plant opening to develop batteries for electric vehicles. That's where the power is for the workers. It's not in, you know, just giving massive handouts to corporations, which is what his solution is. He's just saying it in a different way.
For sure. And Ro Khanna has his vision and he articulates it like this. It's not as, you know, combative as maybe Ray and I would have been in this debate, but take a listen.
Vivek and I completely disagree with what I call economic patriotism. The role of the government to rebuild industry, which has been hollowed out, that's what we're doing with the CHIPS Act to bring semiconductors. I know you're passionate about semiconductors. That's how we're getting semiconductors back into Ohio. Now, for the Republicans, and I, some of this you've adopted, they see any problem and they say, let's cut taxes. Let's deregulate. How is that putting a steel plant up in Johnstown, Pennsylvania? By cutting taxes and deregulation. It hasn't happened for 40 years. You talk about the deficit. The deficit was caused by three things. It was caused by Reagan's tax cuts, Bush's tax cuts, and Trump's tax cuts, and Bush's overseas wars. That's $15 trillion of that deficit.
I mean, that I think needs to be said over and over and over again, right? And we did a story that was basically confirming that, right? That like, I think it was the Center for Economic Progress was basically like, the problem with all of the deficit is that we had 2+ wars under Bush, and then we had a massive, nearly $2 trillion tax break for the ultra wealthy. Meanwhile, now, and we'll move to this, we're being asked to defund the IRS in order to pay for more war. Let's move on to that, actually. tough times if you are a Biden official, beginning with this.
Stop supporting the genocide and ethnic cleansing of the people of Gaza. Ceasefire now. Save the children of Gaza. Save the children of Gaza. Ceasefire now. Where is your pride, America?
As the death toll in Gaza reaches 9,000 killed by Israeli airstrikes, the Biden administration is still not saying the word ceasefire, and they are being dogged for that internationally by peace activists, both in DC and in London. That was a man being dragged out of a congressional hearing with Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, who was making his case to Congress about why the administration needs more money for Israeli weapons. Also weapons to Ukraine, as well as the US-Mexico border. And that was the first interruption, and there were about 4 or 5 more. It was a very interesting hearing. Here's what happened after that man was dragged out.
Stop. Not in the face of an intensifying strategic competition in the Indo-Pacific and around the world.
If the witness will suspend, and I ask that everyone again respect.
Okay, so they got her out of there, and then this happened. From Palestine to Mexico, all walls have got to go is what they are chanting with painted hands, sort of symbolizing blood. The reason Mexico is relevant again is because the administration is asking for money for the US-Mexico border. Again, more money for militarism. But it wasn't just Anthony Blinken. Joe Biden, the president himself, was over at a fundraiser in Minneapolis, and a rabbi stood up in the middle of his speech and said this.
Mr. President,
if you care about Jewish people, I need you to call for a ceasefire. And then immediately when that word comes out, Ray, you heard the get out yelling. That was Rabbi Jessica Rosenberg. Before I kick it to you, look. It was international. Vice President Kamala Harris was in London meeting with PM Rishi Sunak. And this is how she was greeted. can't they just get a break? Okay. So this is not going anywhere, even though I think a lot of the news cycle wants to move on. People on the streets are not. Your thoughts?
Well, it's important that we, you know, keep at it and that these protesters continue to do this to make it as untenable as possible to hold the position. I mean, we talked about it at the beginning of the show, but we saw the first senator, Democratic senator, first senator at all to call for a ceasefire. And, you know, he's a senator from my state. I'm really proud of my state, my city of Chicago. Every single weekend, there's been massive marches in the streets, tens of thousands of people every weekend demanding a ceasefire, an end to the occupation, and one free Palestine. It's been amazing. We're seeing a massive support for, at the very least, a ceasefire right now. And as that protester said, while they were behind Anthony Blinken, you know, 60% of Americans support a ceasefire, and they're right. I mean, it's a majority. And if the Democrats cared about their electoral chances come 2024, which I don't think should be the primary focus, but I think that they should at least be thinking of it, then they would recognize that not only is it 80% of Democrats who support a ceasefire, it's a majority of even Republicans who support a ceasefire at this point. So they're to the right of the Republican voter base on this issue. And yet we see time and time again, the press secretary, speaking to the press and likening protesters for Palestinian liberation to Nazis at the Unite the Right rally, chanting, yep, the Jews will not replace us. She's said that, while speaking on behalf of the administration, that people calling for a ceasefire are reprehensible. That is the Biden administration's, you know, argument right now. And but the pressure is working. Just yesterday, and it's not enough, but just yesterday, Kamala Harris announced the organization of a task force on Islamophobia in this country, which I want to say is not, it's not what the Muslim community is asking the Biden administration to do. They're asking for them not just to change their rhetoric, but to stop supporting a genocide. They don't just want a task force. They want them to actually do something materially meaningful, to stop supporting and stop endorsing, stop financially banking a genocide of the Palestinian people, to show that they actually give a singular damn about the issues near and dear to the Muslim American population, to the Muslim, yes, world. And they aren't doing that, but the pressure is there. We can't let off the gas because, yes, they are cracking.
Yeah, and now the call is for a humanitarian pause. There's going to be no pause in the weapons that will be sent to Israel. If there is a humanitarian pause to let in some aid trucks through the southern border. Again, the southern border between Gaza and Egypt has been opened. A few hundred Gazans have been allowed to leave. Also, Americans, I believe a family from Boston who had been trapped for 25 days inside of Gaza was just allowed out. So this is huge. But you're right that they should be very concerned. You know, the latest Gallup poll shows Biden's approval rating is the worst among Democrats that it's been. So tumbling 11 points in the past 75%, the worst of his presidency from his own party. The drop has pushed his overall approval rating down 4 points to 37%, matching his personal low. That also is a dip with independents, and that is they've declined 4 points, 35% supporting with independents, and Republicans remain unchanged, 5%, which is no surprise. But independents, and these are people who can be to the right, to the left, sort of, you know, hovering above. I think that truly does matter. So as Ray said, the pressure might very well be working. Let's take our second break and we'll be back with much more. Welcome back to the Damage Report. Francesca Fiorentini, Ray Vanna. Everybody, listen to the Bituation Room if you don't already. It's my podcast, and everyone, you can catch Ray Vanna multiple days a week streaming on Twitch. Did I get that right?
Yeah, every weekday, okay. twitch.tv/Ray Vanna.
Multiple meaning every. That's right. She puts in the work. But let's continue a little bit with this theme. Marjorie Taylor Greene, Representative Greene, she might be losing her touch. with the GOP. This is very concerning. You know, we reported last week that Marge brought a resolution to censure Representative Rashida Tlaib over speaking at a protest inside of a congressional building in favor of a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza. And Marjorie thought that was an insurrection. That's right. And her resolution accused Tlaib of, quote, leading an insurrection for her participation in the anti-war protests last month at the Capitol, organized by Jewish groups, which featured scores of arrests. However, how did that resolution go down? Not so good. And even after Marge put out this incredible, immaculate trailer about how terrible Rashida Tlaib is. Take a look.
It's a kind of a calming feeling when I think of the Holocaust. I mean, I think it's really important to understand Israel is a racist state. I mean, this is an apartheid system.
As they shouted ceasefire, as they shouted not in my name, as they shouted never again to
Now, therefore, be it resolved that Representative Rashida Tlaib be censured.
Yes, coming soon to a congressional floor near you, Marjorie Taylor Greene's vote to censure. And did it pass? No. Guys, it didn't pass. That means a bunch of Republicans did not vote for this clearly and openly, let's just call it what is, Islamophobic resolution against one of the few Muslim representatives. The effort required 23 Republicans and joined by all Democrats to vote in favor of a procedural motion that blocked the disciplinary resolution from reaching the floor. The final tally was 222 to 186. So, yeah. It didn't even reach the floor, y'all. Oops. But and like you're like, what happened? What? Why? Like everyone likes to call, you know, Representative Tlaib and Representative Omar is anti-Semitic. Well, Chip Roy, Republican Chip Roy, sort of laid it out. He tweeted a statement on tabling censure of Representative Tlaib. Representative Rashida Tlaib has repeatedly made outrageous remarks towards Israel and the Jewish people. Her conduct is unbecoming of a member of Congress and certainly worthy of condemnation, if not censure. However, tonight's feckless resolution to censure Tlaib was deeply flawed and made illegally and factually unverified claims, including the claim of leading an insurrection. I voted to table the resolution in January 2021. The legal team legal term insurrection was stretched and abused by many following the events at the Capitol. We should not continue to perpetrate claims of insurrection at the Capitol, and we should not abuse the term now. I love this justification. Be like, well, that wasn't an insurrection, so this can't be an insurrection. Nobody say the word insurrection anymore. But this is really interesting, Ravana, because yeah, she didn't even get to vote on this. Everyone was like, this is dumb. Because, you know, if you say insurrection, then it will, it's almost like they would have to admit that what happened on January 6th was an insurrection. So they're kind of calling Marge on, like, again, the double speak and like not to go down the insurrection rabbit hole.
It's funny because this is a deeply personal thing for Chip Roy. He hates Marjorie Taylor Greene. He is, and we've gotten to talk about him a lot recently in the past few months because he has been in the news, angry at Matt Gaetz, angry at Marjorie Taylor Greene. Now, I want to say this is someone from the House Freedom Caucus, one of the most right-wing members of Congress, election denier, supports supports January 6th insurrectionists, if you couldn't tell by that tweet. But he hates Marjorie Taylor Greene because he's one of those Republicans who cares deeply about rhetoric, right? So that's what his issue here was. I will say that, you know, there's nothing that Rashida Tlaib said, even in that deceptively edited video that yes. was anti-Semitic. There was nothing incorrect she said. She said that Israel is a racist state. It is literally an apartheid state. There are streets that you can't go down if you're Palestinian, if you're Arab, if you're a brown person. I mean, you know, this, it has anti-miscegenation laws. The idea that saying Israel is a racist state is anti-Semitic isn't in itself anti-Semitic. I don't think that like Ben Gavir represents the Jewish people. That's a, you know, a member of the government in Israel who had for years in his house a massive poster of a mass shooter who shot up a mosque, not just commemorating the mass shooter, but commemorating the mass shooting itself. And when he finally took it down, he made a point to tell everybody that it wasn't because he didn't still support that mass shooting, that racist mass shooting. And it wasn't still because he didn't still support the mass shooter, but because he had finally gotten enough pressure to do it. I mean, the idea that the government of Israel represents all Jewish people or the interests of all Jewish people is anti-Semitic. And again, Marjorie Taylor Greene making accusations of anti-Semitism, Jewish space lasers lady herself, is so fundamentally disturbing.
It's ridiculous. And so I'm glad that they didn't, you know, at least they're parsing it. You know, this was such red meat for them. They could have easily voted on this BS, you know, resolution, and they didn't, whether or not that it was because of the insurrection language or because they're just, again, tired of Marjorie Greene and the Matt Gaetzes is important. Meanwhile, look, the war on Gaza is having American political ramifications. Speech is being policed. People are being told that they're anti-Semitic if they criticize Israel and its actions now. And that's also happening on the floor, not just with Representative Rashida Tlaib, but with Republicans. And yet no one seems to really be calling them on things like this. Here is Representative Brian Mast on the floor discussing funding for Israel. Take a listen.
As a whole, I would encourage the other side to not so lightly throw around the idea of innocent Palestinian civilians, as is frequently said. I don't think we would so lightly throw around the term innocent Nazi civilians during World War II.
Wow. Okay, so that is Representative Mast discussing, and again, this is within the context of trying to limit speech around Palestine and Israel on the House floor, saying, let's stop talking about innocent Palestinian civilians. There is no difference, just like there are no innocent Nazi civilians, which is just a wild comparison to make, considering I think the word he's looking for is straight up Hamas, but in a lot of people's minds, Hamas and Palestinians are one and the same. They are absolutely not. And for those who need a reminder, Hamas is not the elected government in the West Bank, where many millions of Palestinians live under occupation, with massive checkpoints, different roads they can't drive on, with being shot at whenever they peacefully protest. No, the Palestinian Authority is the governing body in the West Bank. But like, no one's trying to censure Brian Mast for those words, which are arguably justifying the murder of civilians. AOC tweeted, think about how frequently Congress raises the prospect of publicly disciplining the only two Muslim women here, today considered censure, and compare that to the ease in which this representative unfurls bigotry on the House floor. We can stop pretending people are treated equally here. Ray, your thoughts?
Yeah, first I'll just say, because you mentioned the West Bank, that since the 7th of October, hundreds of Palestinians living in the West Bank have been murdered by Israeli settlers, illegal Israeli settlers who have been armed by, as I mentioned, Ben Gvir, literally drove to the West Bank with a minivan full of assault style rifles and passed them out so that these settlers could, with the explicit endorsement of the Israeli government, murder those Palestinians in the West Bank. And they can't even hide under the guise of we're trying to root out Hamas, because as you mentioned, Hamas is not in the West Bank. But I, you know, as to what Mast said, the United States should have taken a second to consider innocent civilians in, you know, he mentioned Nazi Germany. Let's talk about Imperial Japan. How many, and it was justified in the same way. There's no innocent Japanese civilian. And because of that, we dropped two nuclear bombs and caused, you know, however much death and destruction and injuries and disabilities that lasted, brief and agonist lifetimes for these individuals. Yes. Can we still see the continued effects it had? We should have said, what about the innocent civilians in those times? And just like we should be considering it, it should be at the forefront of the minds of the American government now.
100%. I mean, like Hiroshima and Nagasaki were not chosen because of their military strategic importance. To say nothing of like the bombing in Europe that continued, that needed to end after the Nazis had surrendered. And yet many, many towns throughout Europe were bombed by Americans needlessly, and civilians died needlessly. But anyway, that's just history. That does it for our hour. If you're on Linear, it's been a really, it's been nice. It's been a good time. And if you're on YouTube, there is much more in the aftermath. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.